Lamed Amud Aleph. Okay. All right. We're on Masechet Gittin, Lamed Chet Amud Aleph, and we're in these series of stories. Maaseh Shehaya is the expression in the Gemara. Let me tell you about that which occurred, an event that happened, a situation that unfolded, and through the learning of that situation and that event, sometimes we're going to pull out the direct lesson halachically, legally, some kind of law is going to come out, and other times it's going to be just simply an exploration of the story that's going to really gird a values-oriented conversation.
Phrase Maaseh Shehaya rings in my ears. It was used by so many of the writers, Jewish writers, like Bialik and the European. They always start with Maaseh Shehaya.
That's right.
And it's so beautiful. It rings beautiful.
Yeah, and it's very, and it's Talmudic language.
So once upon a time.
Yeah. Well, it's not Hayohaya.
Right.
It's not Hayohaya.
It's Maaseh Shehaya.
Yeah. I think that's actually very different. It's not so much once upon a time as it is very much involved with the word le maaseh. Like, we need to know what happens, Maaseh Shehaya, and we need to know it because halakha le maaseh, we want to get to some understanding of how we should work within the Jewish legal system. Lemaaseh, how we should behave, what we should do, what laws we would pass. So it is an interesting phrase. Okay. So I'm on the word Amte Demar Shmuel. It's the last word. We're on Daf 38A, and it's 38A3 if you've got the article volume. 38A3. And we're picking up where we left off in a certain way. And we're talking about some people who were taken captive. And we said last week, we can't know exactly what the exact situation was and who's out there. But we do know that people are looking to take captives and ransoming people with the intent to make some money. And that is part of whatever culture we're dealing with here. The non-Jews around sometimes too this coming time. So, Amte Demar Shmuel Ishtaba'i. It happened that a non-Jewish slave of the master Shmuel was taken captive. Okay? Parku ha l'shum amhata. And they ransomed her with the intent that she remain status evid, status slave woman. V'shadru alei, they sent her back to Shmuel. Now, obviously, they were interested in making their Rebbe happy. You know, they wanted to do this because he's the leader and they know who she was. And as we said before, we have to realize that these people are within the confines of the community and they're part of the households. Shalchule, they sent along this message. Anan k'rabban Shimon ben Gamliel Sviralan. We hold in accordance with Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, who requires what? That ransom slaves become back to their status. Slaves. At I nami kedrabanan svirlach. And as for you, even if you hold in accordance with the rabbis, who do not require the return of that individual to the status of evet, to the status of slave, if, in other words, if you think that the person's gone three, anan l'shum amhata parkin anla nihala, we will say the following, we ransomed her with the intent that she should be returned to you as status slave. And the implication is what? Even the sages would allow us, if we had the intention of redeeming her, to be back in that situation, to be back in that status by you. Even the rabbis would agree that she has that status. So what does it depend on? In this case, their claim anyway, that their intention in terms of her status, would keep her in that status. Now, as it says here in the Schottenstein, there's an erroneous assumption. What is that? Ve'in hu savor lifnei ye'ush hava. They thought that it was before Shmuel abandoned hope that he would ever have this woman come back in the status of Eved, in the status of slave, of servant. They thought it was before he abandoned hope. Velohi. But he had already kind of said, you know what? I have no hope at all that she's going to come back to me. In other words, was he ransoming her? No. La'achar ye'ushava. In fact, it was after abandonment, though, that they ransomed her. In such a case, what do rabbis and Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel agree that we already established after the whole little piece of Gemara? If it was after that, she's free. She's free. And what did we have some discussion of? When she's free?
When you give up hope that she's going to come back.
Right. When you give up hope she's going to come back, she is free, and then that's a on its face status change for the woman. Okay? Now, we talked about whether or not there needed to be some system that protects against that, because that's the ruse that could be pulled, or that's the self kind of created danger zone that someone could wind up having themselves kidnapped so that ultimately when they're ransomed, they could just go out to freedom. Reality is that in this case, there's no position. If it's after Yeush, if it's after he gave up hope, then she's going to ultimately go out free. There's no holding her to the status. Thus far, rabbis and Shimon ben Gamliel would agree. Now, Shmuel is going to respond. Ushmuel, and as for Shmuel, lo mi baya de ishtab ude lo mishtabed ba. Not only did he not enslave the ransomed slave woman, Ela gita de cheruta namilo atzricha, but he didn't even require her to receive a document of emancipation. Ela gita de cheruta namilo atzricha. He didn't require her to have a document of emancipation. Now, what is the potential problem there?
How do people know she's free?
We're talking about a discussion concerning status of people in the world. If I only had the Gemara thus far, I might think that's not such a good thing. I might want, like a woman with a get, has a get, and she can go say, look, I'm not a chained woman, I'm not an aguna, I can get married again, my children will be legitimate. I might expect that every case I possibly can have a document of freedom, a gita shichrura, or some type of emancipation paper, that I want to actually have that as an obligation. And the system should work out like that pretty much in every case. The fact that it says he doesn't require her for some reason, but yet would accept her as free, might imply the following, if I was to read it really creatively. That he accepted her back with open arms into his household with the status of able now to marry a Jewish member of my household, and simply reintegrated her after such an experience. That's a generous read. I don't really know. It doesn't say. There's no story here. But maybe what it's saying, since he didn't require the Gita Shechruta, he didn't require such a Cheruta, document of freedom, well, in order not to have any questions left around the Jewish world about her status, what's the only way I could possibly resolve the issue? And this is sometimes like the productivity of the Rishonim when it comes to Gemaras, Lahavdil, I'm not sitting with them at their table centuries ago, but I'm trying to figure out in my mind how it might make sense that he wouldn't require the document if the tenor of the Gemara's discussion has been, let me put the right documentation, the right papers into people's hands so we're pretty clear on status around the Jewish world.
But doesn't it imply that if it says he does not require it, it implies that usually you do require it?
So that's exactly, the read becomes through, in this case, he didn't require it, right?
Right.
That would imply that in general,
you do.
Good. The Gemara explains Shmuel's decision. But now the Gemara is going to tell us exactly why the Gemara is Shmuel's decision is made. Shmuel Tamei. Shmuel is consistent with his own reasoning. The Amar Shmuel, Shmuel says the following. Hamafkir avdo yetze lecherut ve'eno tzarich get shharur. That if you declare that your slave, your evet, status person, is free. If you say, Cherut, I'm giving this person Cherut, Eino tzarich get shicharor. He doesn't need a document of emancipation. He doesn't require that. Shene'emar, and I'll bring you proof from a verse. V'chol evet ish miknat kasef. Because it says in a verse, and every slave of a man who was purchased with money. Eved ish velo eved isha. Now, are we to mean that it's only a man's slave is included in the law and not a woman's slave because of the word ish in the verse? Because remember the verse says, every slave of a man. Who?
Cite the verse? I mean, it's just a verse? Don't they say where that comes from?
No, they don't tell you right there where it comes from. I mean, we happen to know that it's from, because of the work of the translation, we happen to know that it is from Exodus 12:44. And ultimately, that's only because in modern times, you had, first of all, some little work within the Gemara page itself in certain printings that actually told you which, at least which book things were from. It sometimes was only in the gutters. We don't have it on our page printed over here, but it might say Shmot. And then you have to remember, oh, that's chapter 12. That was your job. Modern, last 100 years, Gemaras actually added a little tool that's not here either, that actually has the full book of the Tanakh. It's from the chapter, the verse, and now, in the last 20 years, started quoting the full verse. You see that we're actually getting into new with laser printing and how easy graphic design is on the computer. People bringing in all kinds of things to put on a page of Gemara. It's wonderful. Anyway, so back to the mail. They're looking at the extra word in the verse and having a little bit of now discussion about it. So it says about the instance. He doesn't work for his master anymore. He doesn't require the document of emancipation. And he's permitted to marry a Jewess. He's permitted to marry a Jewish woman. And he doesn't need that document. And so are we talking about the evidence of only of men's Avadim? No, we're talking about women's too. Ela, what's the verse coming to say? Evet sheyesh lo reshut l'rabo alav karui evet. Rather, it teaches that a slave whose master has any control over him is indeed called evet ish, is called the slave of another human being. Right? Why is that important philosophically? Why does that come to answer the Shmuel position on the law that if you declare your person ownerless, you don't need a get? Right? Listen to the way this is going to go now, because we're going to have to, figure this out. The law is, according to Shmuel, if I declare a slave ownerless, do I need a get or do I not need a get shihur? No. Reason being, v'chol eved ish niknat kasef. That the slave of a person was purchased with money. What can I do? I can say the person's freed now, and what? He goes out to freedom. Gemara comes along and says, let's ask about this extra word ish. Is it only limiting men's slaves in terms of Shmuel's law? No. It's got to be both men's and women's slaves who can be released through words.
So Eved Ish is not the gender of the slave, but the owner?
Ah, so then it refers to, exactly, it's now talking about, why do we have that expression at all? Because that expression implies that someone has control over another human being, and that person is referred to as an Eved Ish. We call that person a slave over whom his master has control, or some control. She'ein lo reshut l'rabo, and if a person has no authority over another person, ein karui evit, then he's not called a slave.
That's that person.
Okay, so let's... But as to who are we worried?
In this case, we're worried about Shmuel.
As to society, we might be worried still.
Maybe.
Because he didn't get Shihur? And so, I'm left with a little bit of a worry. There's no resolution here. But let's talk about my other question that I was proposing, and then come back to the society issue.
How could you be an Eved without...
Exactly. So you're not an Eved if you don't have anybody.
But can you be an Eved for the church or for the court? Some kind of
right. Is your status going to be in question because you don't get an actual document of emancipation?
Is that what you mean, or do you mean can you be indentured to an institution?
Yeah, institutional.
He means not to a person. You're not an Eved Ish, you're an Eved Kedivah.
Right.
Yeah.
An Eved of the temple or the palace.
Temple. Let's say the palace, not the king, the palace.
Mm-hmm. Leaving the institution of where you can be indentured, right? For a minute, we really don't have, in this case, any discussion of an Eved that's not an Evedish. In Gittin, at least, where we are, the assumption is that a person has ownership over an Eved Kenani. We're talking about an Eved Kenani. We're talking about a non-Jewish slave. Right. So I can be concerned how this law might apply if I was to allow for a system that has avadim serving some other greater institution. Right? As a matter of fact, when people talked about being slaves to the Beit HaMikdash, they really didn't talk about being slaves to the temple. They talked about donating the amount or the value of that person
to the temple.
So you didn't really have a whole systematic layering of slave workers, per se, in that vein. Some people could, you know, lend out his or her labor force, is the way it might work in ancient times. You also had religiously, like Kohanim, who were dedicated to the temple, right? But we're not talking about plantations.
We're only talking about non-Jewish slaves.
Here in Gittin, we're talking about non-Jewish slaves.
So the interests are different.
Right. And with this particular part of the Gemara, I think there is a question about documentation and status as an individual vis-a-vis the Jewish community and your right to marry someone who's Jewish. But the interesting piece of this is it brings up a little bit more of an issue about what's at the core of slavery as a matter within the Jewish tradition, which I'll get back to as soon as the other... Oh, I'm sorry, Alex, you were not done?
The slave is unprotected without something.
Well, we've said that before, because we are into this world of documentation and wanting to see that protection come forth. It's true. And I think you can make the case that it would be very unprotected. It sounds like that.
Even aside from the slave, if it's an economic thing, since we're talking about it, so how would anybody else know?
Right. So that becomes, in my estimation, also a problem, which is why the whole question of documentation and whether he needs a get is one of the central ones within these pages of Gemara. I don't think we'll come out with Shmuel's ruling as the way that things ought to be, just so we know. This is just here as part of the discussion of what's going on within the whole legal unfolding of this area of law.
But it's interesting that they're willing, that at least in this part, they're willing to accept the uncertainty of it.
Yes, and that's a piece of how Talmudic parlance works.
Ebed Ish, are we assuming that women couldn't own slaves?
No, as a matter of fact, the assumption of the Gemara here is that women do.
So is the rule different?
No, so that's what the question was. Ebed Ish below Ebed Isha? A slave of a man is going to be treated any differently under the law than the slave of a woman? No. And that's why Ela... Rather, I'm going to tell you what it really is coming to teach you, because we all know that whether you're a slave owned by a man or owned by a woman, it falls under the same thing according to Shmuel's outlook. That if I say he's free, and I don't need to write a get. I don't need to write an emancipation paper.
So, you know, according to our thinking, I would be worried that somebody that didn't have documentation, how do you prove that the owner really freed, emancipated the slave, and then how do you go forward since you don't have any proof of it, and other people knew you beforehand as a slave, and how do you reverse that? But in thinking about how this is all like tikkun olam, the basic thing is not necessarily the individual liberty, but the order of, or the marriageability, so that you have the next generation will be perfectly kosher. So I think that in that regard, they probably want to make sure that so they can marry again, that they are legitimately free and able to marry Jews, and that that's legitimized.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I do think that is underpinning the discussion about making clear status laws about status.
So the children are...
Both about the individual and especially about the children.
My confabulation as to how this works, not to defend it, we bring a modern judicial approach to this, is the minute the slave comes back to the master, and the master stands there and treats the slave in a non-slave relationship, that's immediately obvious to everybody in the household, and therefore the external world. Well, and so the very fact that the owner's behavior toward the individual reflects the change in status probably permeates the small community's recognition of the individual.
I would say so.
Do they come back to the house?
The word shiur, so Rishu Rabo sort of lends some weight to that.
Yeah, exactly.
What was this referring to?
In effect, a slave who's, I'll phrase it this way, that the authority of the master is obvious, or is apparent, he's accepted. I mean, the thing about Rav Shmuel's position I like is the fact, if you're a stranger in town, then how do you prove, in other words, somebody who was never an Eved, how do you prove that you're not somebody's Eved? I mean, if you need to have documentation to show you're no longer a slave, anybody who was never a slave to begin with still is absent that documentation.
I have a full
proof of status.
There's also the implication that the person has to go back to that household, and therefore, by not giving the person independent verification of his status, the person has no choice. So in some ways, he's captured again to that household.
I have a problem with that commentation. Every person is born free, Knani or Yudi, it doesn't matter. Then, or you volunteer to be a slave, and then there you nikna, and then there is a process of documentation, or you're being caught by bandits and being sold. So how the Jewish people can accept buying from a bandit a slave and make this documentation legal when they knew that the capture was not legal? So the whole documentation is just to hide something rather than somebody that volunteered to be a slave and sold himself so the family can be raised. So I think it's cover up rather than real transaction.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes these sugiyot tease out the underbelly of what the system might be lacking, and that is, you know, the notion that we would suspect just about anyone and not give them the independence. I think they're debating that issue. They're trying to figure out what's the best way to actually achieve that. And the authority being apparent, the hope that there could be some level of communication that someone now has achieved free status, barring, you know, the community coming together for a big chuppah, because immediately the person is free to wed somebody Jewish, and they're being a very well-known eved now freed in order to wed, which sometimes seems to happen within the context of our stories, that there seems to be this freedom to go ahead and create this marriage. But that seems to be even a little bit more within the family, so that maybe there's some keeping folks close and at hand for whatever free status people lend to that kind of family structure. But if we think that there's any kind of complicity in promulgating a system through the fact that we ask for documentation that then proves that yes, the ransom was paid in the right way, and that's the only way it can kind of
happen. Yeah, but even if
the
ransom was paid the right way, the guy was stolen.
Yeah.
He didn't volunteer.
I understand it. I do think that...
So it's about the burden of proof, shifting the burden of proof.
No, you shouldn't accept it. You shouldn't buy a slave from bandits. That's it.
Oh, I agree with you, but I think that we have rooms about that.
No, I don't think that we have.
Well,
discussing.
Right. So that's ultimately where it gets back to: should you or should you not ransom? Going back to the very beginning of the story. I mean, we ultimately come down on the side, if you will, in the tradition of pidyon hashvuim. We come down on the side of making deals to actually free, at least our own free people.
Shvuim is not avadim.
I understand, I'm willing to go with you with making the distinction. We definitely ransom those who are free and family and those among us. What's that?
Pidyon habayim.
Yes, same root, right? We redeem the child. But when it comes to avadim, we very well could have just said, never shall we, in order not to create the system where anybody demands a lot of ransom for people, but Maaseh Shehaya. Well, here we have it, that we're in the midst of the Gemara, we're in the midst of their experiences, whether or not it's exactly these facts, or this is the legal narrative that was built on any number of cases, and Shmuel is now opining, according to the Gemara's editors, in the way that he would have in such a case, leaving aside.
Was being a slave always worse than being a poor, really poor, non-slave? Because in many other ancient cultures, slaves were better off than many slaves.
I think part of the possibility, the possible side here, and we said this about those who were impoverished and those who had really the struggle to find somehow to live among those who seemed to be organizing society well enough and sharing resources in that vein and had enough food to eat, and is that they indeed wanted to create a system whereby people had some rights under the law and had some participation within community, according to the Jewish tradition. Again, these non-Jewish slaves, you brought them, right, we said this, brought them to mikveh, circumcised them, they even that way could partake in the Pesach offering, we said the other night. But we know that certain captives were indeed taken captive. We weren't out there necessarily warring and battling for them at this point in history. We definitely have it within Torah, and we're grappling with Torah how to actually confront the whole system of having captive slaves. And for that matter, just to bring us back to where I think the verse brings us at the end of this little sugya, or this little maaseh, kind of reminding us with this verse that boy, we've got a system of slavery here that human beings have established. Eved Ish. Let me remind you, folks. We're talking about human masters. We're talking about slaves. And we're talking about words of masters that could ultimately lead immediately to freedom. And so when I say it, I mean it. Words have to mean something. It's not just documentation, regardless or in light of all the problems that documentation can create. And I want, at this point, the Gemara wants, Shmuel wants, his words to mean what they mean. And the Torah's system of allowing for this to happen at all can just be undone by the words that Shmuel speaks, which is a lot of power, a lot of potential power. And the Gemara, I think, constantly asks questions. Are you willing to free your slaves with the simple formula of you're free? You know, I think that there's some questions going through here, this part of the Gemara, about the possibility that more and more we should just invoke the notion of getting to that place in terms of our relationship with these folks who are around, who are working for us laboriously, and who are potentially part of the community, as we've said, on a deeper level. And the story that we already, again, we're going to hit one or two things that we already hit as moments of looking with the foreshadowing we did to this part of the Gemara. Those stories will now be in context as to when that great moment of freeing a slave happened. Right? So that's just my reminder that I'm foreshadowing what we're going to do. But last time, to push forward, last time in the Beit Midrash, somebody said, well, what about these non-Jewish people? And really, that we allowed them to be either taken captive, or we stood for the people being left there, or what was the relationship with those people? And, you know, didn't we want to get to a place where we did go and redeem, because it was so insulting to even our avadim, to our slaves, that they should possibly be in the hands of others, because we just felt like, how could that be? How could that be? So what even deeper level, philosophical level, how could we, if someone was taken captive by non-Jews, how could we allow for the proliferation of Avodah Zarah, of idol worship, and other kinds of their religious pursuits now with more of the people that we gave a little status to in our community as being just before full freedom part of the minyan? How could we allow them to go as gone to the mikveh circumcised individuals to potentially participate in the worship of such and such a god with these people who took him captive? And how could we allow her to bear the children of those idol-worshipping Tardumians? So that's a little bit of the kind of context of the next piece that's going to come in the Gemara. So it happened. Amte de Rabbi Abba Bar Zutra Ishtabei. It happened that the slave woman, a woman with slave status, of Rabbi Abba Bar Zutra, was taken captive. Who was she taken captive? Parka hahu tarmuda'a l'shum itita. An idolatrous Tarmudian ransomed her. So that's not even the person that took her captive. He ransomed her, intending to have her as his wife. Shalchu le ledide, the rabbis in that area sent Rabbi Abba Bar Zutra, he sent him a message. I ya'ud avadat. If you wish, do the right thing. Shadad la gita de cheruta. And send her a document of emancipation. Free her. Well, what's the possible reasons why he might free her?
So she can come back free.
So she can come back free.
And the kids will be fine.
Oh, or the kids will be fine where? By her new marriage or by our community where she comes back?
It depends where the kids will live. It doesn't matter to us.
No, she doesn't have kids yet. Are we worried about her impending new wedding coming up? This Tardumian wants to wed her?
That's what you said.
That's what the Gemara says. Or do we want her to be freed because we want her to come back to our community? And then there would be no problem with the kids if she's a free woman and got married to a Jew.
Well, maybe they're just trying to do a take on Abraham and Sarah in Egypt.
Ah.
And tell us what Abraham should have done.
Okay. So is it going to mean, with Abraham and Sarah, that Abraham gets out alive, and so does Sarah?
Well, there were two occasions, right? When
Sarah
is in the harem, and once with the Egyptians. And where's the second
one? We have with Malchizedek.
Abimelech
was not Egyptian.
No, but there were two.
Yeah
right. So I just didn't remember the second one.
Right.
Okay. So, and they needed to be confident, that she had not been taken into the bed of Abimelech or an Egyptian.
Or Malchizedek.
Right. So that was, so it seems to me there's a parallel construct here, but I don't know if the answer.
Okay, so maybe they're just doing it. Maybe they're doing it to save her from being caught up.
Right.
In there. So that part is what's going to come out.
Yeah, but it's not better to keep her a slave. This way you have ownership on her, and then you can demand her rather than free her, and then you have no power over her. So she becomes his forever.
Yeah, this is a little This is...
What I said, if you release her, let's say she was captured and you release her,
right.
Then we have no title about her. We cannot...
So now he marries her
or whatever, it's his property.
She still can make a choice.
If she cannot make a choice because you already he decided for her.
So if we ransom her and she's free, that's what I'm saying, could she voluntarily marry Tarmuradagon?
Tarmudian.
Okay.
Right.
We don't know who I was talking about.
Yeah.
Is this voluntary at all? He wants to marry her? Is she giving her permission to this? Is it really a marriage or is he just...
You know, in the Bible, there is the case that Isha Yafa Nishpet Alidei Yehudi.
Right.
A Jewish guy in a war takes a beautiful woman, so to speak. He gives her 30 days to mourn about her husband.
Right.
And then he marries her. She has no say.
But does he really marry her?
Yeah. She becomes his wife.
Yes, wait a minute. But are these real marriages, or are these just saying... He decides.
She has nothing to say.
This case is a matrimony.
She has nothing to say. She was captured in a war.
I agree. He bought her.
So let's get back to this one. Now we've missed the match a little bit, and we know, but the hypertext to where we are all in focus for the rabbis of the Gemara. It's really important that we are bringing these things to bear, because we're reading not in the vacuum of traditions about avadim, about enslaved people, ownership, reshut issues, who has authority over whom, relationships with non-Jews in this case. We have this notion of a Talmudian named, obvious idolater. The hope is that Abba Bar Zutra would do the right thing, right? Ya'ud avadet. If you want to do the right thing, you send Gita de Cheruta. You send her an emancipation paper. Now, we don't know exactly at this point what it's exactly for. We could, from the way the Gemara unfolds, simply read it aloud as, I could tell you what the Gemara says, but we're just going to read the Gemara. But I like to read the Gemara step by step, without really understanding what the understanding is based on the story, you know, reading the last chapter before the first, right? So here, you're not really sure. Does he want her to free her up because ultimately that will allow her to marry the Talmudian and not be violating any kind of religious connection she's got to the Jewish world? What will that do? Let's just say, what will that mean for her? Let's keep reading. Hey, Chidami. Now, what's going on in this case? It's even a stronger Hey, Chidami than we usually get. What's going on with this case? Tell me about what we mean by this case. Do the right thing, write her a freedom document. E dematsu parkela. If the rabbis were capable of ransoming her, lama li gita de cheruta. Why was it necessary for Rabbi Abba to send her a document of emancipation? Why didn't they just go and ransom her and go and get her? E de lo matsu parkela. And if the rabbis were not capable of ransoming her, ki shadar la gita de cheruta mai have. Then if Rabbi Abba would send her a document of emancipation, what difference does it make? Freeing her up over there. Okay. The Gemara explains it like this. Le'olam dematsu parkela. Actually, the rabbis were capable of ransoming her. And although that Talmudian was going to take the money from the rabbis, it was necessary for Rabbi Abba to send her an actual document of emancipation. V'chevan d'mishadarla gita d'cheruta. For once, Rabbi Abba would send her a document of emancipation. What would actually happen? Habure mechabre ahadade ufarkela. The local Jews would be inspired then to what? Band together and go get her. Because they want to what?
Save her from idolatry.
They want to save her from idolatry. Absolutely, they can't let a Talmudian marry this woman, and they can't allow for this free woman who was living within their community, the Jews there, right? Ahadade, mechabre ahadade. These people in the community would do it, not just the guy who had an ownership issue with the woman. It's not about necessarily chattel, completely just about the movable property. It is about the larger kind of picture we create for those who were in that status within our community doing, God willing, what was reasonable work and not being completely abused and not being completely... It's not a slave system like that. We said we have to disavow ourselves of all the slavery picture of the plantation and the whipping and the chains. And we have to really understand what they would do. And they would see that not as, oh, this isn't a person that can just be freed like that, and she's not a Jew. No way. Indeed they would. Indeed she would be. Because when she's freed, she would achieve the status as being a Jew.
We're assuming she starts out a non-Jew.
That's right. And simply by him... Simply,
well, it doesn't say that.
Well, no. Kenani is a term. Let's not get confused. We're not talking about Canaanite origins.
No,
we're talking about anyone of non-Jewish origins. Right. Canaanites used very, very wide.
I didn't see in the text an explicit statement that she isn't Jewish.
Well, because we assume she's an Eved Kenani. That these stories are all about Eved Kenani.
Okay.
And the fact, though, that he sends her an emancipation document brings her to the status of Jewish community.
So she's a member of the community. Is she also a Jew?
when she comes back.
And that is somewhat...
She's not. And she's still looking on...
So the fact that the Jewish community would respond to her as if it had an obligation
right.
to her.
Right.
Exactly,
right.
exactly.
But that they need a form.
And is she a Jew?
I mean,
again,
the form is a little crazy.
What you
so
want...
Is Mary is a Jew? Is that... I mean...
So, that's the answer. Is she a Jew? Was identity as complex a matter? Back to like you know your point about Rashut, the authority of the Master. Identity, in its complexity, is not as much at the forefront as someone proclaiming their Jewish identity today, maybe in front of a Beit Din. Could she get married to a Jewish person? Yes. Is she a Jew?
No.
Yes. Yes, she's accepted into
so
the
that's
community.
That's a very nice way.
Because she got that her roots.
So that's the best way to have a conversion. Yeah.
Well,
right.
I will tell you that
like
what we're seeing, is
emancipation.
That's right. It's conversion by emancipation. And so again, another instance of, and this is my point about Jewish doorways open to people who want to become really part of the community. Yet another way the Gemara actualizes the hope and the you know, authoritative notion of people able to join our people is by having emancipated avadim completely join our people with full status of marriage rights within our people.
I don't think this is the Rabbanut concept.
Yeah,
no.
Does this apply today in any?
Because it is
no, absolutely not.
No, because just think of what
we
do with
they will kill you before.
All the Syrians.
What it does...
I mean, if you think about the analogy, it's all the Syrians today also.
What it does philosophically...
That is extraordinary.
GERD is the position that we ought to be seeking in many ways and however possible the ability to convince authorities to do what's in their power to truly educate, to truly bring people into the fold. If you want to use this for the philosophical notion of being a people who has the expansive version of what it means to create the Jewish people and today bring more people in order to provide them status of marriage, then you simply can look at these stories as if they found their way to be open as such, we have to create systems whereby we convince people that it's really worth doing all of the conditional kind of conversion pieces that we really do need as very serious plans of study and outlook on what it means to grow a Jewish identity. I mean, not everyone can just, we can just say, yes, you're in. And those who have tried, by the way, have not really succeeded in replenishing the Jewish population with any serious number of serious Jews. But there is openness within the rabbinic tradition of finding many ways to include people who are trained and live a Jewish life. So let's say about this Eved Kenani who's a male. We're going to get to him. We're going to get back to him in a minute.
He gets circumcised. Woman,
he gets circumcised.
We don't have quite as strong evidence.
He goes to mikveh. We don't have as strong of evidence, except to say that if they were using mikveh for the men, we know that there's got to be some rituals that the women did go through. We know that they live a Shabbos life because it says that you and your eved are going to rest according to Torah. We know that they are being trained in the laws and the legal ways that is rabbinic culture. And therefore, again, one could use this as a philosophical platform to say, look, there's got to be transitions for people who abide by Jewish law and for whom we write the right documentation affirming their status within the community. That's the point. However complicated or deep that system has to be. All right? So let's now take the comments, and I knew there was some.
There's no, it's not a volitional act on the part of the woman.
Well,
the community is.
That's what I'm saying. That the side is not from the woman's side.
Right.
The side is from the community side, and the outlook we have about willingness or not to accept that person who was within the community, not considered status Jewish and able to marry, and then how we transition her in from this community side.
But except presumably she's going to marry a Jewish man.
Now,
so that
if she will come back.
No, no, but I'm just saying, in terms of volition, her decision.
But it's after the fact.
Well, yes and no. I mean, you could argue that her decision to marry the Jewish man is the final act of conversion, which is volitional.
But maybe she has no real choices. She's
right.
Back to where she was before. They're just
right.
calling her something else.
Yeah. Right.
Could be. Could
I mean,
be.
She becomes, in essence, an indentured servant, but she's a married indentured servant.
I don't know.
She's a free, married
woman. She's
a married to
a
husband status.
Right.
She is free as her husband will.
You're not talking about the Baal.
Well,
you're not in the Gemara.
Yeah, but that's what that's
that
the life.
Is different than the other.
But the focus is not on her.
That's different than being an abbot.
What's that?
Entitled to all of the protections of
a wife.
Right. Right, but if she's an abbot,
it's chabure mechabre ahadade. The entire community goes out and gets her once she achieves that status. You know, that's a very, very big difference than the Baal or the Adon, the potential husband or the master goes and gets her and then has permission to marry her. The community brings her back in. Anyway.
Am I presuming correctly that an Eved cannot become Jewish while still an Eved?
Well, can't become Jewish while still an Eved, but except while they're in your domain as an Eved, you'll see from another story or two just down the line that, yes, I'm going to actually make the transition right now. You'll see in a second. So the presumption is not that they cannot become while they're still in your domain.
They can?
They can.
So this woman, I mean, it's conceivable that the woman could have been Jewish when she was taken by this fellow?
No, she wasn't.
No. We're talking about a situation where, because the Gemara tells us...
I know we're talking about, but she could have been.
Well, if you're saying in the world of the rabbis, could there ever have been Jewish people taken captives by non-Jewish people? And who wanted to make them their women, their wives? Yes, that could have happened.
I'm just focusing on the Eved who was a woman.
Yeah.
Wondering if that Eved who was a woman could have been...
If she's called an Eved Kanani who's a woman, she's a non-Jewish slave. So if you really want to say, are there at this time an Eved Ivri? Are there people who are, let's say, either slaves by all means for their entire lives or in the status of slave as a Hebrew slave? Then you could possibly have a Hebrew slave.
I'm just wondering if you can be converted from an Eved Kanani... to an Eved
Yehri. No, she's being released and then she's...
Yeah, I hear you. I see what your question is.
I'm asking
so
whether it's possible. I'm an Eved Kanani.
Without an abduction.
Whatever happens to me, I somehow become...
A path to citizenship.
I somehow convert as an Eved while still an Eved. Is that possible?
Yeah. So the Eved Yehri, like I could in essence say, oh, I just received my freedom. And by the way, I'm so indebted to you, Henry, that I want my status to be an Eved Ivri by your estate. Okay? So, could you do that? Yeah. I mean, I suppose you could do that.
But
we're talking about...
I'm working for you, and you could somehow make me a Jew?
So, if you're working for me... If I have rights to you, you're an Eved Kanani. I brought you to the mikveh. You're circumcised, and you are participating in many things in the community, including eating Pesach offering, and including doing all the lo ta'aseh mitzvot. You're not allowed to do XYZ, same as women in our community. Let's leave it there, because then what do you become?
You become a Jewish woman.
You
it's a transgender thing.
Right. You're a Jew, non-Jew.
That didn't happen in this parak. I don't know where you are. I don't know where you're reading in the Talmud, but that didn't happen in this chapter.
I'm interested for other reasons.
So what is the reason? And then
tell me
what you want to
come clean, Henry. Come clean.
I mean, to
He has a woman hiding in the closet.
When you're a Jew, there are mitzvot that you have to do. There are things that you do. It could have been that the things that are required of a Jewish person can't correctly be done by somebody who isn't Jewish because they don't have control over the things that a Jew is supposed to do. That's why I was asking him, not necessarily.
No, that's why you have to really have a status change, and then you become obligated. And that's a piece of the transition here is that the obligations change very distinctly. And like we were saying before, like how would people know, right? It is definitely the way that somebody has authority over you or treats you. But it's also the very fact that if you're a man, particularly, you have different obligations. The women are the different question by way of how we make that evident. And therefore, the whole question of whether or not you need the documentation becomes even more important in terms of the women in the picture. Ari.
Historically, we're talking about the Roman period.
Yes.
How did that look when you're saying that the community should be responsible to try to get this person to become Jewish? Here you have like conversion of a non-Jewish person in Roman times.
Right.
I mean, I don't see that actually happening. I can't imagine that the local Roman community or whoever was in charge would allow someone.
Well, I would say quite oppositely that it probably did happen even more often at that time, and a little bit more on the local authority of where people held and which authorities...
To convert to Judaism?
Yeah, and here's how. Remember, we said at that time, and I brought forward this statistic, there's disagreement entirely about how many million, but remember there's many million Jews from Rome through the Middle East up into Syria, Turkey, that area, what we call those countries today. And what you have are, particularly during the Roman Empire, communities that know that they're basically Jewish communities living amongst, let's say, in this landscape of Judea, the Idumeans are here, and the true Romans are over here in Caesarea, and you have very distinctive communities by way of which temples and what kind of gods and which worship, and then you have a lot of other population who's over there as well, who have been there in many ancient different configurations and ways, and you have some of them in this Evid status, a lot of them in this Evid status, because Rome was pretty big on this law, and happens to be that our law reflects a lot of the Roman law of the time, with a little bit more advanced notion of documentation for individual, for women, especially in marriage status. So you might get somebody who left this little area, and they go back and say, no, absolutely not. You're not keeping that woman. She's back our way, and by the way, she's a free woman, and she's marrying in here, which is kind of how I'm just going to make this shot really set. She's coming back and she's marrying in. Meaning that the Roman authority is over here in the big city and the Roman authority is over here at the port and the Roman authority is up here where they have their garrison. They're letting suburban life unfold over here. And in little groups arguing with other little groups and people being, you know, being a pretty populous area and time there where they can live, because remember the wilderness is also still abundant and there's lots of places that you don't want to really live in those areas because of all kinds of animal life and all kinds of paths unbeaten, you have a little bit more of populations in this kind of reality and dialogue, and they're saying, no, you come and be part of it. Again, we have to leave some of our modern sensibility about converting. They're just in the Gemara's age trying to understand whether or not conversion really means sitting and learning a corpus of law and understanding any kind of diachronic history. There's one position in the Gemara that does say that you teach the person a little bit of these laws and a little bit of those laws, and
say yes immediately to the meat.
And then you do it immediately. There's another that says no, we push them away for years and years, and three times particularly, and really encourage them to take on the whole history of the Jewish people, to know it diachronically, in a certain way, to take on the tsurot shel am ha-yehudi, to know what it is they're getting into, to understand that they're a persecuted people, so then teach them the laws. At this point in rabbinic history, during the age of the Gemara, we see that there are debates about just what it means to actually open this up to anyone. An area where that seems not to have the same threshold by way of people who come and ask to be part of things and ask to convert is with non-Jewish avadim, because they really live with us. They really are part of the community in many ways. They are living the unfolding life of rabbinic culture that we talked about when we all studied Shabbat together, and they were creating the culture of the Sabbath, and they're creating the cultural reality of abiding by rabbinic law as it's being developed. So this is one of these moments here and notions of, well, are these people, should they be part of our community or should they not? And so, yeah, it was happening. And this was the Maaseh that was. So I see this more as totally possible than not. Tarmudian.
Tarmudian, right. Isn't it possible that they're not so respectful that he rapes her? You know, he likes her, he takes her, and he rapes her. Now they free her, and she comes back, and she's been raped by this non-Jew, and she's free to marry. Everybody wants to marry this woman who's been raped? And
that's exactly why I went to the parallel with Abraham and Sarah.
She didn't anything.
No, that's the whole commentary in the Tanakh. The language is abundantly clear of how much they have to, in my estimation, you know, zigzag to make us aware that she was able to keep her integrity intact. So obviously it's a huge question.
She was a married woman and they allowed this. I mean, when someone is kidnapped, then there's no allowing. Yeah. Here is Abraham allowing this to happen.
Here's my thinking about what's going on here. Yeah. They want to get this done. They want to get it done quickly. They want to figure out how to preserve her integrity, and they want to make the Talmudians well aware that, you know, quote unquote, you picked the battle here, and we're going to win.
Yeah, there is a nikmat dam, by the way, on issues like this.
There is, except that in our
nikmat dam,
there's
the
blood revenge.
The guy will come and kill the guy if you raise.
Yeah,
but let's
not worry about that piece so far.
And she's not a Jewish daughter.
But if we have ownership,
and he documents the man's
he abuse our ownership?
Here's Bobby, an answer to your question as to what will happen once she's freed, and if we get this freedom thing accomplished really quickly. This is from the Gemara's era, and we're not really there. Right. Well, she's free to marry. So, Ibaid Ema, if you prefer to say, I'm now on 38A4 for those following in the Schottenstein, and I'm on Ibaid Ema. In the Gemara, towards the bottom of the page, it's Aleph Bet Chipchuk Aleph, right? Ibaid Ema Leolam Delomatsu Parkela. If you say that they were not capable of ransoming her, right? In other words, the Talmudian was not willing to really accept any money for her release. Nevertheless, they still made the request of Rabbi Abba to write her the emancipation paper. The Chevan de Mishadarla, once he would send her that document, Gita de Cheruta, of the document of emancipation, here's the hope, Mitzala ba'ape umifarekla. She would become cheapened in the Talmudian's eyes, or at least she would become less desirable for all intents and purposes. And he would then permit her to be ransomed. In other words, if she was freed by the Jewish community right away after taking her captive, for whatever that means in that time, right, exactly. We don't really understand why, except to say that now they're going to really insult the Talmudians, and I forget who said last week, you know, but don't they see about the non-Jewish communities out there that they just simply can't have this because of what they represent out there. Well, here it is. The Ha'amar Mar, and the Master said, Haviva lehen behemtan shel Yisrael yoter minishotehen. Idolaters prefer Jewish animals to their own wives. And in other words, they wouldn't release her if she was simply a slave woman. But they don't want our women. They think Jews are really the lowest of the low. So if she's Jewish, they're not going to possibly want to marry this woman. And do we run the risk of them really being criminal? And do we run the risk of assault? Do we run the risk of mistreatment? Yes, we run the risk. But somehow, the Gemara is trying to work out the neighbor, the diplomatic relationship that we have with this other people. And here's the way that they ultimately did. And a get shichrur, a document of emancipation, seems to be part of the key in order to make it happen. And so, you know, the whole story, all the details we can know and all the details that we only can make up aside, what's that issue here in terms of the read of the Masechet, where we are, what we see coming out with answering the other question about what if you didn't have to write a get? Well, here, sending her the get seemed to be the key to change the whole reality of what might unfold. I see the document in this case as being then somehow answering the sugya that just came before us, which was, well, what happens if you just want to free her and you don't have to send any document at all? Well, this is what happens when you send that document. Ultimately, it provides status in the world. It says to this Tarmudian clan, keep your hands off. You loathsome people down there wouldn't want her anyway, and they, quote-unquote, you know, throw her back, right? But it was the get shichrur that I'm interested in. It's the document somehow. It's the paper flying. It's the authoritative stamp of Rabbi Abba. It's the world of legal documentation beginning that has some power over the outcome of what is just a terrible situation. Terrible situation. Now, compelling, not compelling, does the story have to go that far and debase and be all engaged with the notion of learning about non-Jewish slaves and taking captives and protecting them and calling them bestiality lovers and all these things? Well, in a certain way, it's trying to save us from our very animalistic nature. It's trying to save not only the Jewish community from that animalistic nature, it's trying to make a tikkun between the Jewish people and the Talmudians even. Yeah, that's my strong read. Hani mili betzina, they say this is so only in private. Aval befarhesia, zila behu milta, publicly, however, it's beneath their dignity to exhibit such desires, and consequently, the Talmudian would be shamed by having that bill of emancipation to the slave woman, and he would consent to getting the situation fixed according to the way the Gemara sees it. And that's really where it ends in terms of this ma'aseh, among others. Yeah?
A free focus on the concept of ransom.
Mm-hmm.
This Talmudian, he wasn't the one who captured this lady, this slave woman. He ransomed her. And it implies that when he does, he has some sort of control over her having ransomed her.
Mm-hmm.
Because he...
That's true.
Is that... I mean, because the usual concept of ransom is not conferring any kind of ownership or control right over the ransomer necessarily. One ransoms somebody. Like the Jewish people are ransoming her.
Yeah, here you have a culture of what happens when people are taken captive. And that stems back from where we were talking about in the Torah, that you do have situations where people are taken captive, and then as captives become status avadim. And we're dealing and grappling with that concept.
I mean, it has to ransom your brother or whatever, but it doesn't give you control over...
No. That's a different kind of ransom. Here we're talking about...
So it's the same part, but it's a different...
Yeah. It's a paying for freedom. It's a paying for freedom. It's a paying... Yeah. All right. Let's go to another incident. Okay? All the time, by the way, we're getting closer, and we're getting closer to the moment that Henry asked about, which was, does all this really need to ensue in order for there to be freedom among your slaves? Okay, so that's really where I think we're going towards tonight. Anyway, Hahi Amta Dehava Befumbadita. There was a Canaanite slave woman who lived in Pumbadita, one of the great centers of learning in Babylonia during the rabbinic era. Dehavu Ka Me'abde Ba In She Sura, with whom men perform very sinful acts. Stop, period. What's the problem in my society if I allow for women to be around who have Canaanite Eved status, and I can't say that they're allowed legally to be married to the Jewish men? This is one of the problems. Thus we get the stories. I'm creating a servant class. Right? And I'm not worried now that the men around have the mitzvah of Eshet Ish. I'm not worried that adultery becomes the issue. Because if their status is not of a woman who can be married, I've now set myself up and set up a system where I could really be abusive. It's brought forward in the Gemara not to be telling some, you know, so we can get the rated R section. It's really, I believe, an inner commentary on some of the deep problems within the situation. This is in Pumbedita. So not to be taken lightly. Not to be taken lightly. That it's in Pumbedita, absolutely. So Amar Abaye... He loved the Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel. Were it not that Rav Yehuda had said in the name of Shmuel, Kol Hamashachar Avdo Oved Be'ase, that anyone who emancipates his Canaanite slave transgresses a positive commandment, Hava Kayafna Le Lamara, I would force her master, the Chativ Lagita Decheruta, to actually write her a document of emancipation. I could fix the whole problem if we freed this woman, because they're committing such a crime. But were it not for the fact that I have a limud that Rav Yehuda said in the name of Shmuel that I'm transgressing a mitzvah aseh, a positive mitzvah, if I free a Canaanite slave,
how does that fit with what we just did before with a freed Canaanite
slave? Oh, that's nice. So ultimately we're getting the same kind of party to the big picture here of the legal system, right, Bobby? Right? Shmuel is involved?
Yeah.
And did he free a slave over there?
Yeah,
he did. Over here, you know, you kind of get this story where the first assumption is that he's a little hesitant to actually free it. So maybe it is about, what do we do? She is somewhat one of these women who's now got this reputation, or who would really want her, and can we get her married? Okay. The Gemara records a dissenting opinion. Ravina Amar, Ravina said, Ki ha mode Rav Yehuda. In such a case, Rav Yehuda concedes, Mishum milta de asura, because of the prohibited acts to which her status leads. In other words, the master may emancipate the slave. He concedes. Because we can't have her status in this neighborhood leading all these who are supposed to be fine young men to have such
protect the men. You've all noticed that.
Yeah.
Protect the men.
Maybe we should get rid of the men and leave the women.
Right. Maybe. Abaye says, Mishum Isura Lo. He doesn't permit the emancipation of slaves due to prohibited acts to prevent them occurring. We don't we say that about... don't we have a question In other words, about Abaye. Wouldn't Abaye really allow it? Because Abaye said, were it not for this other limud. Ha amar Rav Chanina bar Rav Katina amar Rav Yitzchak. Rav Chanina bar Katina says the name of Rav Yitzchak. Maase be'isha achat shechetzia shifcha v'chetzia bat chorin. There was an incident involving a woman who was half of a slave and half free. In other words, yeah, because two different people had claims on her value.
No, I think
two different estates maybe had claims on her value, and one says, of course she is free, and the other holds on and tries to economically pull her into the labor force. The chafu et rabba v'asa abat chorin. The rabbis forced her master and made her a free woman.
Already half.
Right, they free the other half, in other words. The Amar Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak, and Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak says about the incident, Minhag hefker nahaguva. The men acted with her in a permissive manner. Apparently, that was what was putting him over the edge here in terms of forcing the freedom, that there were people really acting in a permissive manner with her, and she was acting that way. The Gemara now says, "Hacha hashta." Now, are you going to compare this case to that case? Hatam, there in the case of the half free, half slave status. Lo levid chazia v'lo levin chorin chazia. She's not fit to marry either a slave or a free person, because right, this half can't marry that half, and this half, because we have all kinds of things with marriages of these people and their status. We've got to find a way. Remember that the rabbis have this philosophical idea that it's better to be in a marriage situation. Here, in the case of the Pumbediten slave woman, right, it's possible for the person who really is in control, Rashut Aleha, the one with control over her, to marry her to another Eved. And that Eved would be able to what? Umantarla, he would be able to guard her. In other words, from the advances of those other people. Now, it kind of goes back and forth about, you know, are we going to try to fix society with emancipating our slaves? Are we going to try to lessen the possibility that this uncouth behavior really is wiped away by the situations that we hope for? Can we see that marriage could do that for the Eved Kana'ani class, the status Eveds in our midst, the Avadim? Will their marriages protect against the kind of immoral behavior that we're worried about? Or shall we be pursuing a full community where there's no Eved Kanani, but there are freed Avadim, and they should just all marry in Jewish marriages?
So they're service people rather than Avadim.
So they're trying to figure out how not to really have that as a piece here, I believe. And there's no answer. There's no good answer. Yeah, I mean, look, you have a reality. So there's a wonderful woman who's a professor at Rutgers who writes about the quote unquote oldest profession in the book, right?
Yeah, so is that what she...
And I'm not sure. The Gemara goes sometimes and takes great pains to actually call prostitutes prostitutes and puts them into stories. I mean, we have that is a literary trope that we can trace. This woman was not called as such, but the system here seems to, in some ways, suggest that
That's what happened.
Yeah, the system here seems to suggest that the system might be abused
right.
in such a way
yeah.
that
the master's sons are always with the slaves.
Well, it sounds like this is the scholars and
the only thing history teaches us
don't
know.
Right.
So if you're going to the master's children, the master's children are a big problem. And unless you're going to come up with a system.
They had to pay her so she had something to live on, otherwise she had no source of livelihood.
Yeah.
And she's not talking about having any other skills. Just as she put in all the money.
Right.
So they had to have paid her. I mean, then that's what they're so upset about. So
yeah, I think that you've got a real red light district.
Right.
You have a red light district
right.
here. And
it's taking money and it's taking attention.
Right.
It's taking time.
Exactly.
There is a story in the Bible, I don't know if it's Dina or that somebody raped one of the sisters.
Tamar.
Right.
Yehuda and Tamar.
I don't remember the name.
Pilagish, I think he's talking about Pilagish Baliva.
And then our tribe said, if you all get circumcised, we will allow you to marry her. They did it.
That's
Dina. So it's Dina. They did it, and then they killed them all.
Right.
So what was Dina's status at the time?
Trouble.
No, it's very...
She was a Jewish woman.
She was a Jewish
woman. She
was a captive.
She didn't come in Evan.
She was a captive.
She was a captive.
So?
She was a Jewish captive. We have a long history of defending
to
ransom her.
But we allow them to marry her as long as they will all, the whole tribe, the other tribe will circumcise. That was the condition.
No,
It wasn't Dina, but the idea wasn't that
by getting circumcised they were going to accept them. They got them circumcised so that they could kill them.
Right.
Very clever suggestion. Because they would be slower in their battle. They'd be suffering.
They were recuperating. They were.
Right.
I mean, that story stands quite the opposite philosophically of what I was suggesting is any kind of openness to seeing the family expand. So it's not as though the other side doesn't have its...
Jacob condemns his sons to kill them.
Right.
You know, it's not that's viewed as a great moral victory.
So obviously there's several tropes about this issue within all of our...
For sure.
Or literature, and there's
sure.
no one way we can be
for sure.
walk away with saying we understand
yeah.
how they felt about it.
Well, let's put it this way: by our side, we are trying, and this is one of the places where we're classically trying to work out what do we do, and what do we do with someone who has this status that's in our midst, and can we even free them? And here, this last answer was: well, wait a minute, shouldn't we just keep them the slave status and have them get married within the whole slave status culture that we've got going on? And now the Gemara is going to turn. So I want to get to these before we leave tonight. The text itself, Gufa, let's talk about this whole notion of actually emancipating slaves and whether or not it's a mitzvah that I'm transgressing or not. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel. Rav Yehuda said in the name of Shmuel, Kol HaMeshacher Avdo Over Ba'aseh. Anyone who emancipates a Canaanite slave transgresses a positive commandment. Shenamar la'olam behem ta'avodu, for it's stated regarding Canaanite slaves, la'olam, forever, ta'avodu, you should have them work for you. Gemara ultimately is going to say, wait a minute, meitaveh, I'm going to bring you a very early on source, a Tanaitic source, to confront this kind of teaching that says you got to keep them enslaved forever. Ma'aseh b'Rabbi Eliezer, right? And now I'm giving you the full context because we've only read this little piece in one of the times that we studied earlier on. This is now the context. Meitvei Amar Rabbi Eliezer, regarding Rabbi Eliezer, Shenichnas Baveda Knesset, he went into the shul, below Matza Asara, and there wasn't a minion that day. So he's hanging out with his master, he's hanging out with his Rav, and he's got the Eved status, remember, and he's not taken captive, to get to your direct question, Henry, v'shachwer avdo v'hishlimo la'athara. And he freed his slave to make the minyan. He freed his slave at that point so he could become a full-fledged Jew and make the minyan.
Right.
We, that,
exactly,
and that question was asked the last time, and we're so suspect, I think, of the Gemara that it seems like a good question. I'm not sure we have to ask that question.
So after the minyan,
he didn't free him on Tanai. He didn't free him on a condition.
That he will stay.
Seemed a little impetuous.
I don't know that it's a little impetuous. I think it's the symbolic. I know we had this discussion once before. I think it's the symbolic mitzvah of he brings him in, and instead of it being the marriage thing, he brings him in and says, this guy is kosher lemahadrin. This guy is kosher. He can be part of the minyan. We're going to now say, devarim shebikdusha. Listen to the follow-up. Gemara does answer, mitzvah shane. The fulfillment of a mitzvah is different, though. Although one may not ordinarily emancipate a slave, he may do so if he will thereby fulfill a mitzvah. Hence, Rabbi Eliezer was permitted to emancipate a slave. That is not an answer of, do we suspect it was only for a mitzvah, which some people have read like this. Let's read like this. We are now going to apply a principle to the pasuk that said, la'olam bahem tavodu. You have to forever keep them at work. Ah, but where am I going to find the loophole? When there's a mitzvah to consider at this moment, which is not like some case of somebody being taken captive and somebody needing to be ransomed. It's a mitzvah to do within our community because we now understand the importance of mitzvot within and among the Jewish people. We are now going to free this guy. And we could do the same, the implication in my book, which is not written here in the Gemara, I admit to you, but I think the implication is, and so too with a woman, when we have a mitzvah in front of us, and it's not just this culture of we have to stop them from doing a veirot, we have to stop them from transgressing, but when we have a mitzvah, we can overcome the force of the Torah's verse that says, Deraita, lo'olam tavodu, keep them enslaved forever. So I think you get to a place within these conversations that ultimately allow for the build-up of the Jewish community, of those who particularly live within it. I'm not suggesting that it's so expansive as to say all non-Jews come hither and we ultimately can just take anyone at any time and say we need you for a minyan. But it is with those who are living within the community, who have a certain knowledge of our culture, legal constructs, and wrap them into community at the very moment we either use the phrase they're freed, and especially when we're willing to write a get shichrur to actually create the emancipation paper that's necessary. I knew you were going somewhere.
I'm going home. Thank you.
Next week is Purim on Wednesday evening, and then the 30th, Rabbi will be a guest teacher.
I'm, I'm, uh, uh, uh.